Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Tuesday at 5. RPM is about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Every week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in NYC. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Yo, what's good, New York? This is Jack Devine, he, him pronouns, and you are listening to Revolutions Per Minute on 99.5 FM, live from the new WBAI studios. We're a socialist radio show and podcast for members of the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. The DSA is the largest socialist organization in the United States, with 56,000 members nationwide, and NYC DSA is its biggest chapter. We are run by our 5,500-plus members and organizers who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. Something is stirring in the United States of America. Not only is a Democratic Socialist the front-runner to become the Democratic Party nominee for president after a landslide victory in the Nevada caucus, but after decades of slumber, labor is in revolt. Rank-and-file workplace struggles have spread across the country over the past few years. Throughout this episode, we're joined by UAW member and Labor Notes writer Chris Brooks, who is organizing with Unite All Workers for Democracy, a national network of rank-and-file UAW members who are organizing to take on their employers, challenge concessions, and clean up the union. Meanwhile, in California, academic workers at UC Santa Cruz have been engaged in a wildcat strike to fight for a contract that covers their increasingly high cost of living. This past weekend, I interviewed Sarah and Veronica, two leading organizers of the strike out west, as their struggle seems poised to spread across the UC university system. Last but not least, we'll hear from RPM host and special correspondent Lee Zishi on the national grid hearings in Albany from earlier today. But first, Simone Norman with the weekly headlines.
Governor Andrew Cuomo announced a willingness to turn over New York's DMV database to federal immigration authorities, but without the Social Security numbers, after the federal government froze the Trusted Traveler program for New Yorkers. The congestion pricing program may be delayed beyond its original start date of January 2021, pending a regulatory decision by the U.S. Department of Transportation. The Staten Island DA's office is compiling an internal list of police officers it will not call to testify for fear their testimony cannot be trusted. This comes after a similar list in the Brooklyn DA's office was released following a FOIA request. State Attorney General Letitia James is suing the city's Taxi and Limousine Commission for inflating the price of medallions. Although the state's ban on single-use plastic bags goes into effect March 1st, there is still some confusion among customers and retailers over how it will be implemented. The NYPD is investigating Ed Mullins, the police union boss who declared war on Mayor de Blasio. And in election news, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez announced a slate of congressional endorsements, including NYC DSA endorsee Samalis Lopez in the Bronx, along with the launch of her new PAC for progressive challengers. Boris Santos, who received the NYC DSA endorsement for Assembly District 54, announced that he is suspending his campaign for personal reasons. Four candidates have announced they are running in a special election to fill Rafael Espinal's seat on the city council, and you can find out which of those candidates are running on thethorn.nyc. Shirlane McRae, the First Lady of New York City, is launching mental health podcasts in partnership with Brick Arts Media, a Brooklyn nonprofit, leading to some speculation that she plans to run for Brooklyn Borough President in 2021. And finally, a bill to establish an online tool for voter registration is being held up in the state assembly and so may not go into effect in time for this year's elections.
Our weekly headlines are brought to you by The Thorn, an incredible weekly newsletter by NYC DSA Electoral Working Group covering local politics and radical activism. Subscribe at thethorn.nyc.
So on today's show, hi, this is Amy Wilson, and I am a host of RPM, and I'm also a student of labor studies at the CUNY School of Labor and Urban Studies. So I'm very excited to be here in the studio today because what we're going to be talking about is really labor history in the making in a variety of ways. So to help us do that, we have our comrade in DSA and a great journalist, Chris Brooks. Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for being here.
Hey, thanks so much.
So before we dig into today's topic, the UAW, would you mind just telling us and the audience a little bit about yourself, what brought you into your organizing and what you're doing now?
So I'm a staff writer and organizer at Labor Notes, which is a media and organizing project that's been around for 40 years. We organize what we like to call the troublemaking wing of the labor movement. So we believe in building militant, rank-and-file led unions that are fighting for everyone. So on progressive issues, fighting for immigrants and racial justice, as well as taking on the boss on the job. And, you know, I come originally from Tennessee, moved to New York 4 years ago to work for Labor Notes. And, you know, I can see, the big difference between being in New York and being in Tennessee in terms of the role that labor can play. It's important.
Here at RPM, we love both troublemakers and people who take on the boss. So we're very, very happy to have you.
That's very true. And you're representing the labor branch of New York City DSA, right?
That's right. Yep.
Awesome.
Before we get into what's happening right now in UAW, I think it is really, really crucial to talk about the history of this really important union. So, like, during the New Deal period, or the emergence of the New Deal, especially the second New Deal of 1936, the UAW was the crucial transformative force. It was one of the most powerful working class, if not the most powerful working class institution in the country. So, can you, like, describe how that history can you describe a little bit more of that history and then also get into what has changed? Why has the UAW become a less effective institution for working class power? And, like, how did this power erode over time?
Yeah, I mean, so if you think about it, the entire way that we live is predicated around the most quintessential American product, which is the automobile, right? Like, so the creation of the suburbs, the interstate system, the way that groceries get into the store, the way that we get to our jobs, all of it is predicated on the ability to drive. So it's really no wonder that some of the biggest companies in the world in the 20th century were auto companies. General Motors, for example, when the Fortune 500 came out with its list of the biggest companies in the country, it was number one on that list on the very first list they put out. And then it topped that list 37 times in the next 45 years. So GM was the biggest private employer in the world in the second half of the 20th century. And auto workers were employed in the millions in the United States. But kind of like the way that we think about retail workers today, oftentimes is they were unorganized and the work was seen as really terrible. And unions weren't capable of being able to get in there to really crack it, you know. So Walmart today might be something that's very synonymous to what General Motors was in the 1930s and 40s. But they did crack it, and they did it through militant mass action, especially using things that were new in the United States, like the occupation of plants, or the Flint sit-down strike, when, you know, over 2,000 workers went in and they ended up having to fight, you know, the police outside. You had brigades of women, the wives, like, coming out and, like, standing in between, making sure that they were protecting their husbands in the plant. And this is what gave birth to not only just the UAW, but a militant labor movement in the United States that was organizing across the industrial sector. So not only was GM the biggest employer, but it was also the biggest consumer of glass and steel and aluminum and zinc. All of these other major industries in the United States were dependent on automobiles. So whatever the UAW ended up winning in its contracts would often trickle down to everybody else. So they were the first to win major pensions. They were the first to win employer-provided health care. They were, you know, setting the standard in the economy for what blue-collar workers could win of the goods that capital was producing. And it didn't just trickle down to unionized workers, because many non-union employers wanted to de-incentivize organizing, so they would provide similar benefits and wages to the unionized sector in order to get their workers to try to think, oh, we don't need a union, right? It didn't always work. So, you know, the UAW really came out as a powerhouse. It was an explosive, militant, progressive organization. It was at the forefront of the civil rights movement. But that all started to change in the 70s. In the 1970s, we had the biggest recession since the Great Depression. And what the auto companies ended up doing is saying, like, we need to, you know, Chrysler especially needed a government bailout. And one way to think about how important these companies are is the fact that the government has to keep bailing them out, right? Every time that they keep overproducing.
Right.
So Chrysler in 1979 said that they needed a multi-billion-dollar bailout. And the government, as a part of a condition of giving these loans to the company, said that you have to reduce your labor costs. And the UAW agreed to that. So the UAW set a new trend in the labor movement by saying that we're going to agree to concessions. So this is hard for me to imagine, like, you know, because I'm under 40. But there was a point in time in the labor movement where every time you went to the bargaining table, you assumed the contract was going to get better. Right? Mm. Like that was the trend up till about 1979. And now all of a sudden there's this big trend in the other direction. Cause it's like, well, if the UAW agrees to concessions, how can we say no? Right? So then the UAW said, okay, well, in exchange for concessions, and they gave them at General Motors and Ford as well, we want labor management partnership. And they thought it was going to bring in industrial democracy. But it turns out what it did is it just opened the door for the interests of the labor leadership to be more aligned with that of the company executives. And this is what eventually gave birth to the corruption in the union. Part of what happened is they created these things called joint training centers. So these are nonprofit entities jointly run by the union and the company. And the company would just funnel millions of dollars into them, and the labor leaders started taking it. It was just a giant pool of money that was totally unregulated. The membership had no idea of being able to see what was happening with it. And I mean, it's kind of like explosive. You know, there's this corruption scandal that's happening right now, and this is kind of what everybody's been talking about. But between 2014 and 2016, Chrysler was paying 100% of the salary and benefits of dozens of UAW officials. There were UAW officials, including the two former presidents, Gary Jones and Dennis Williams, that would go for weeks, sometimes months at a time, living in private villas in California during the Detroit winters, playing thousands of holes of golf, buying tens of thousands of dollars in cigars and premium liquor and steak dinners. They ended up buying so much golf equipment with Chrysler money that Chrysler paid for a semi truck to drive it all back to Detroit for them. So it's really incredible what people are finding out that's happening. So as of today, eight union officials and the widow of a former union official have been indicted. Three Chrysler executives have been indicted. And what they found is it wasn't just Chrysler that was funneling money to the UAW, but the UAW leadership was also embezzling money from the union itself. They were also giving inflated contracts to vendors for union produced goods that they would then get kickbacks from. And all of this, like I said, like is tied to this history of labor management partnership and concessions, right? Because it was what opened the door for them to think, well, you know, we can work with the companies on these issues. We can work to see that their interests are aligned with ours. And over time, the companies were really capable of exploiting that in order to say, you know what, we're going to give you all these goodies. And company executives in the court records that have been produced have said that they did it all as political gifts to the unions in order to get further concessions and to keep union officials fat, dumb, and happy. That's an exact phrase.
Wow.
Yeah. In general, I think that was just an incredible summary of how the lens of the UAW gives you a really critical understanding of both the emergence of the New Deal order when it was a class struggle formation, that the UAW, there could be no compromise because at that point the auto companies were not going to compromise with unions. They were trying to crush them. It would have been a long history. So there was it was almost this force where they had to struggle to actually develop these working class institutions. But then after decades of kind of this grand bargain where there were kind of gains on both ends, the moment that the auto companies could break working class power in any way, they forged basically what is a class compromise with the leadership of these unions. And that maybe first, you know, some of the leadership really thought that this was the only thing that they could do to survive, but it created a circumstance in which power really shifted away from the shop floor, and it really became about this kind of like, oh, let's find a way to just like manage our decline.
Absolutely. That's 100% accurate. And you know, what goes along with that obviously is the Red Scare that happened in the CIO, because there was a militant force in the rank and file of the UAW that had to be stamped out by the leadership. So the UAW has been run for the last 70 years by the Administration Caucus, or the Reuther Caucus. It was literally created by Walter Reuther in opposition to the socialists and the communists, who he purged from the union. Like, you know, you go back, there's interviews with old timers, you know, from the Flint sit-down strike, and they say that McCarthyism in the labor movement shouldn't be called McCarthyism, it should be called Reutherism, because of the way that he used that in order to silence his opposition over time. And the Administration Caucus has operated as a one-party state within the UAW. And the way that all one-party states operate is that when corruption happens, when there's issues that arise, they don't expose them publicly to deal with them. They keep them in-house and they try to cover them up. So this has been what's happened, is that you've had the same grouping of people all working together in order to shut down militancy, to keep outsiders out, to keep reform from happening within the UAW, and then protecting each other in the long term. And then the people who rise up in that system are often the worst of the worst, which is what we've seen, especially with the last two presidents.
Yeah, and I think it's one crucial to note that even with all this corruption, there's clear evidence that having a union is always better than not having a union. There might be corruption in the union, but there's always corruption among capital, and they're doing whatever they can to break worker power. So it's the point here that we're trying to make is not like unions lead to corruption. No, it's that when union leadership is collaborating with capital, it is going to start replicating the practices of capital, which is breaking worker power and concentrating the wealth and power into a small sect. So it's really difficult to break this because, one, people don't imagine an alternative, and then they also see the alternative of not having a union. Things are really bad. So there is kind of a defensive posture, and also the general picture of the global economy as capital has more mobility than labor. But I guess before diving into the specific campaign, can we talk about how this kind of perception and reality of corruption has served the interest of the car companies to break organizing drives in plants where the union does not have a presence?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was in Chattanooga in 2019 for the Volkswagen organizing drive that was happening there. And it was pretty incredible. The anti-union campaign just completely blanketed the city. So what you would see on the radio and on television were these commercials where they had a blacked out figure that was a quote unquote UAW whistleblower speaking in like a baritone hell demon voice that was like, every dollar you give to the union is one that's going to the boss, you know. And this was you would go to the gas station, and they have videos playing on the pumps, and it's that video, right? So the message that they were giving to the workers was that there's no reason to unionize. It's futile to do so because you're just giving your money back to the boss, right? That's the message. And obviously, like a lot of the workers, I think, that ended up voting against the union, it wasn't necessarily that message. It was the fact that they were running captive audience campaigns in the plant where they were saying, if you vote for the union, we're going to close this place, which is a huge problem. But it did have an impact, right? People looking for an excuse or people looking for a way out are going to hold on to anything that they can, and it makes it that much harder. But it also means that it's that much that's that much more important for the left and for the rank and file to say, you know, we actually recognize that this is a problem. It's demonstratively true that there is corruption in the UAW, but we recognize that this goes back to a long history of the union leadership selling us out, which is why we need to put an end to that. We need to put an end to the concessions. We need to put an end to the labor management partnership. We need to go back to the militant history of the UAW of fighting the boss on behalf of not just auto workers, but on behalf of everybody, right? Because these plant closures like Lordstown and other places impacts the whole community. It devastates these communities that they operate in. So every plant closure in the United States should be a referendum on capitalism and its failures to our communities. And it should be an opportunity to have a discussion about why we need a Green New Deal, why we have so much, you know, manufacturing capacity in the United States that could be harnessed to produce the kind of economy that we all need. And auto workers could be at the forefront of that conversation if they had that kind of a class struggle union.
Yeah, I think bringing up the history of organizing outside of the workplace and not just focusing on these what maybe it's bread and butter issues, which are obviously important and need to be central, and the current union leadership has been failing on that side of the spectrum too, but thinking about things in a broader social analysis and a power analysis, and that looking at, here are our enemy, here's the owners of our lives, we have to sell ourselves to them every day, and how do we break their power? And we can't do that by just thinking about things in the factory itself, but in the broader social and political circumstances. But before we dive more into the campaign that you're involved in, I just want to remind our listeners that you are tuning in to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. To connect with us after the show, you can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com, or you can find us on our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com, or on Twitter at NYCRPM. Today, we're talking about rank-and-file union struggles, whether that's within the UAW or out in the California university system. And we're joined by Chris, who's been sharing both the history of the UAW and now is going to talk a little bit more about the current fight within UAW to build rank and file power. So what is the Unite All Workers for Democracy campaign? Who is involved in this rank and file struggle? And what is your organizing strategy and what are your demands?
So Unite All Workers for Democracy is a national rank and file movement of auto workers that are trying to take on the corruption at the heart of their union and rebuild it from the bottom up. So it's composed of auto workers from across all the big three automakers, GM, Chrysler, and Ford, as well as graduate students. Many people may not know this, but the UAW is actually the largest representative of graduate students in the United States. What they're trying to do right now is get enough locals to pass a resolution that will mandate a special convention where they can change the union constitution to where they don't have a delegated system that's controlled by the administration caucus, right? This one party ruling state, but allow for the direct election of top officers by the membership. So one member, one vote is their demand. And this isn't like pie in the sky stuff. This is what the Teamsters won after they were controlled by the mafia for many years. The government forced it to happen. So they're following in the mold of others before them, like Teamsters for a Democratic Union or TDU, which is one of the most important caucuses in the United States. And so they're modeling themselves off of that, like a movement of Teamsters that were capable of taking on a corrupt union leadership that was also forcing concessions on them and in the middle of like a hostile government, scandal, investigation. And to chart a new path. So it's in the Teamsters, it's in the steelworkers, it's also in the machinists. So they know that this is very possible. So they're currently getting locals to pass it, all across the country. And through doing that, they're identifying activists in locals that are on board with this idea that, you know, we're ready and willing to take responsibility for our union to clean it up, if we're given the tools and the resources to do so. And this is incredibly important because the Department of Justice has said explicitly that they're considering a government takeover of the union. And under a Trump administration, especially, that's a terrifying prospect, right? So they're looking to file a RICO suit, a racketeering lawsuit against them with the idea that they could send in a government overseer who could then make all kinds of very bad decisions for the union. So right now the members are saying, you know what, we don't need that to happen. We can run this thing ourselves if we're given the opportunity to do so.
And that would, if the Trump administration took over the union, it would be a liquidation of the worker power.
It would be completely terrible. It would be very bad.
Yeah,
yes.
I can only imagine the horrible things that would happen in that if that actually goes down. And I think you hit on something really important is that, yeah, this is not pie in the sky. This is not some utopian demand. And in fact, if you look at the most effective worker struggles, and, you know, we stand in solidarity with the UAW workers that went on strike in the past fall, but I think it's pretty clear that their strike was less effective than the teacher strikes that have been happening over these past couple years. And those were led by rank and file movements that took over their unions democratically. And not only just that, but were waging a social justice unionism campaign that they were talking about issues that were beyond the specific workplace and connecting it to a larger critique of capital. And Amy, I know that you wanted to ask a question that was related to this campaign with DSA's broader work.
Yeah, absolutely. So, we are here on the radio show of New York City DSA, and we're all DSA members in the room. And so I think it's sort of, it's interesting to me to look at what is the crossover between DSA and UAWD. So the national organization released a statement of solidarity on February 12th that's pretty strongly worded. It goes through the history that Chris just shared with us on the airwaves. And it also says, we encourage all DSA members in UAW to join the reform movement by becoming a member of UAWD. And when I read that, my eyebrows sort of went up because this is a direct open intervention in the internal union politics of one of this country's largest and most historic unions. And so I'd love to hear your thoughts on what are the significance of that and what do you see as the future moving forward of the relationship between DSA and this movement?
Yeah, so I think it's incredibly important for all socialists and leftists to say that, you know, our role is to not just rebuild any labor movement. It's to build a certain kind of labor movement, right? One that fights for everyone, one that is democratic, one that is that has a vision of society that's about challenging the boss, right? And that's been the role of socialists, I think, in rank and file unions across the country. I mean, like, it was socialists that gave birth to TDU, the Teamsters for a Democratic Union. And now there are people in the UAWD that are socialist as well, and I think that they're trying to project that vision and to say this this is the important work that we can be doing now. And, you know, many DSA members are graduate students across the country. Many of them are probably UAW members. So it would be really fantastic for them to unite with UAWD, which they can do at UAWD.org, as the website. They can also find Unite All Workers for Democracy on Facebook. And they can start, you know, plugging in. We have regular phone calls. The first national meeting of UAWD members is going to be at the Labor Notes Conference in April. It's April 17th to 19th in Chicago, so it'd be fantastic to have folks there. But in the long haul, I think that, you know, like we were just talking a minute ago, is about, like, you know, like all these plant closures and about the need to rebuild a green, sustainable economy. That's only going to happen if we have the political will to make that happen, and it's only going to happen if we have the unions that are capable of mobilizing working class to fight on that vision. Both of those things, I think, require socialists to be doing the really strong grassroots organizing work of rebuilding the unions and building, you know, like getting someone like Bernie Sanders elected, right? So I you know, and then on top of that, you know, I think by, you know, many DSA members went out to the GM strike lines, right, which was fantastic. They're doing all this great strike solidarity work across the country. I hope that they were capable of building some, hopefully, like long-term relationships with some of those auto workers. It'd be great for them to go out and talk to them about all this. Like, hey, I heard about this campaign and this network that's happening out there. Like, are you a part of that? Like, we would really love to support that. You know, we can't just, you know, send all the socialists into the plants. We can also bring some of the people in the plants to socialism, right? So that should also be a part of the vision that we have.
Right, exactly. So you said that a lot of DSA members might be represented by UAW because they are graduate students or writers. There's also the National Writers Union that's under UAW. A few weeks ago, we had folks in the museum world on RPM. A lot of people in the museum world are represented by UAW. So it is a bigger picture than many people expect. But still, the majority of workers represented by UAW are in auto plants, right? So hopefully as well, you know, this relationship could go both ways. And as we're identifying these really awesome rank and file shop floor organizers to sort of bring those goals and those movements closer together, right?
Absolutely. Yeah,
it's enormously exciting, I think. I'm into it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's immense potential to really build the bonds between different sort of workers. That this represents this sort of struggle that could not just transform the union, but help transform the organized labor movement. And I think we're starting to really see that happen. So we're about to go to an interview about the strikes, the Wildcat strike that is going on right now in the University of California system in Santa Cruz. And we're going to talk a little bit more afterwards about how that is spreading. So I think while you're listening to this interview, I think our listeners, it's really important to think about how this struggle in UC Santa Cruz connects to what we've been talking about today, and then thinking about all the other worker actions that are going on around the country. So we're going to roll that interview right now. It's with two Wildcat strikers out in UC Santa Cruz.
Hey, so I'm here with two Wildcat strikers from out in UC Santa Cruz. I'm here with Veronica and Sarah, and they've been engaged in the struggle out in the California university system. I just want to thank both of you for joining us on RPM.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Before we get specifically into what's happening right now, like, why did this struggle emerge at UC Santa Cruz? And what ways have steps towards privatization put pressure on academic workers there?
I think one of the most significant things that got us to this place is a failed contract campaign, or, you know, our union, our statewide union, signed our contract when the majority of workers at UC Santa Cruz voted against it. And so in that vote, we also said, we're ready to strike now. And that was a year and a half ago. And so since then, there's been a lot of other kinds of organizing around housing issues in Santa Cruz, particularly around rent control, and then potentially around building tenants unions. And then last spring, a group of organizers got together and ran for the Graduate Student Association. These are all union organizers, ran for the Graduate Student Association and won those seats based on our campaign for a cost of living adjustment. We've been working on that for several months now. And in December, we voted to start a grading strike after several failed conversations with administrators about the issues relating to housing and cost of living. And we withheld grades at the end of fall quarter. And then in the beginning of winter quarter, voted to withhold winter grades. And then after a threat to fire people, or a threat of severe discipline, people voted to go on a full teaching strike. And so we're about to start our third week in a full teaching strike.
So you mentioned how there's been this other organizing that's happening, like outside specifically maybe of the university, and it what would classically be understood as like a workplace struggle, because people have been fighting for housing justice, for trying to build tenants unions. So like, how has this informed your struggle? Like, how does it link to your demands with the university and the administration? And like, how does it connect to the contract that you discussed that you believe is a bad contract?
I could speak a little bit about that. So I think it's really important to understand what has happened to the rental market in Santa Cruz over the last decade. Santa Cruz is about 30 minutes, a half an hour away from really the epicenter of Silicon Valley. And so the cost of housing, the cost of renting in this city has gone up astronomically over the last few years. And there are no protections for tenants here. There's no rent control in the city. So at the same time that workers were organizing to reject what we saw to be an insufficient contract, we were also organizing on the city level to pass a rent control ordinance. And we were unsuccessful in both of those campaigns. And I think those twin defeats, our failure to reject the contract and get a better deal, and our failure to pass a rent control ordinance that would help to control and put limits on how much landlords can charge for rent, actually set the stage for this wildcat strike. I will also say that another dimension of this is the fact that the university itself is the largest landlord in Santa Cruz. And in fact, the cost of rent for people who even live in subsidized housing on campus is extremely high. So, you know, for students graduate students who live in student family housing or who live in graduate student housing, they are often faced with an extreme rent burden, paying 50 to 60% of their paycheck back to their boss, who is also their landlord.
So you hit on two really important things that I think our listeners, it would be helpful for our listeners to understand why this has gone down, in the sense that just like here in New York, out in California, rents are skyrocketing for people, and it's harder and harder to live with an economy where there's stagnant wages. But then also there's this disconnect between the rank and file members of the union, such as yourselves, and the union leadership acquiescing to what is a contract that is not sufficient to meet the demands of the workers in the union. So how does this rank and file fight for a more militant union connect to the other worker struggles that we're seeing over these past few years?
I mean, I think what this struggle really demonstrates is where worker power comes from. And it's not from the bureaucracy. It's not from a small group of elected leaders. It really comes from the members and the ability of workers to act collectively, to withhold their labor, and to organize and strategize and really determine the horizon of possibility for where their actions can take them. And I think that's what we're seeing in this wildcat strike. And we see the way in which it is inspiring other rank and file workers on other campuses who are starting to say, well, why aren't we on strike? We're also struggling with the cost of living. We're also struggling to make ends meet. And the way in which this strike has really opened things up across, you know, other units in our union is really incredible.
Yeah, I would just add that, you know, after we signed the contract in 2018, we saw mass resignations in our union and people finding other ways of organizing. And what I think is so beautiful about the Wildcat strike and where we are at now is that so many of those people who felt disenfranchised by that process are now feeling empowered by their ability to withhold their labor to get their needs met.
Yeah, it's not abandoning the fight for increasing working class power. It's actually engaging in a more intense and militant way to actually reach the demands. So, I mean, you've both mentioned that the strike has begun to perhaps spread to other campuses. And the strike is in its third week at UC Santa Cruz in terms of the full withholding of labor beyond just a grading strike. The actions were particularly intense on Friday. There was a lot of militant action, not just from the striking workers, but across the campus. So, like, what is the current state of the fight and where do you both see it going from here?
Yeah, I think the last several days, the whole 2 weeks, but especially the last several days, we've really seen the commitment that people are willing to make to this fight. And so on Friday, Janet Napolitano, the former head of the Department of Homeland Security and now the president of the University of California, Janet Napolitano, as well as our campus administrators, have threatened to fire us if we didn't turn in fall quarter grades by midnight Friday night. After a lot of discussion, many graduate students voted to continue to withhold grades. So they're going to, if they follow through on these threats, we're going to see mass firing. And people understood the risk and said, this is too important. We have to keep fighting. And I think that's really exciting. And we saw how that energy and that commitment has inspired people across the UC, all of the UC campuses. And so at UC Berkeley, they occupied a dining hall or liberated a dining hall where they encouraged people to come and eat for free. We saw occupations of like the library at UC San Diego. And we also saw strike polls happen at several other campuses. So it sounds like there are several campuses that are ready to join us.
I mean, I want to say that I think one of the other exciting components of this, and this is really consistent with how I understand the teacher strikes that have happened over the last few years, is really the participation of students, undergraduate students who are now receiving a tremendous political education through this action, but who are also educating us about their struggles and their relationship to this institution, student debt, racism, sexism, transphobia, homophobia, the presence of police on our campus. You know, all of these concerns are being raised alongside of this strike action, and we are finding ways to find and build power with one another.
Yeah, it really seems like a very impressive show of worker power that is building into a movement that could potentially shift the dynamics within the California university system and beyond. So I just want to say that RPM stands in solidarity with the striking workers out in UC Santa Cruz and hopefully across the entire UC system coming soon. And I just want to thank you both so much for joining us in RPM.
Hey, thank you. Let's spread the strike.
Yeah, spread the strike.
You are listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. Connect with us after the show. You can email us at revolutions@nyc@gmail.com. You can find us on our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com, or on Twitter at NYCRPM. Today, we've been talking about rank and file worker struggles, both in the UAW and out in the UC Santa Cruz campus and the whole UC system. At the end of that interview, we were talking about the strike potentially spreading to other campuses. And just last night, the UC Santa Barbara graduate workers voted to walk out starting on Thursday. So we're really starting to see action not just contained within one campus, but spread to all the others, as also the energy and the activism and the organizing is intensifying within UC Santa Cruz itself. Just go online and check out some of the videos from Santa Cruz on Friday. So we're going to open up our phone lines for the next 10 minutes or so. So if you have anything you want to talk about rank and file struggle, if you want to talk about just anything happening in the labor movement, in the socialist movement, what's happening with Bernie Sanders, please call in. That's 212-209-2877. Again, that number is 212-209-2877. So, Chris, you were just listening to that interview as much as you can. You know, we were also talking in the shop. And so how do you see that, you know, struggle out in California connecting with what your fellow organizers are doing within the UAW?
So, you know, it's incredible. They're members of UAW 2865, which is actually the second largest UAW local in the country because it's enormous. I mean, they represent 20,000 graduate students. I think only half of them are members. But still, like, it's an enormous bargaining unit, large number of members. So what they do there really impacts auto workers everywhere. I mean, auto workers lost COLA as well, cost of living adjustments that they're fighting for. The auto workers lost to concessions, you know, years ago. So, you know, I think that what's incredible is not that just that it could spread across the campus. My hope is that this militancy, the idea of being like, you know, screw the contract, screw the no strike clause, screw our leadership, we're going to go out on the demands that we all believe in, right, together. I mean, the UAW was renowned for its wildcats in the 70s and 80s. So if that fighting spirit that we see right now, just it's incredible. Inspiring in the UC system. If that could spread from there to the auto workers, you know, in Flint, to, you know, in Tennessee, in Kentucky, in Indiana, and all these places, if it could spread to there, that would be, it would just be incredible.
Yeah, we're not just seeing the rank and file struggle spread in general, but specifically what we've been talking about today within the UAW. So I think that is probably a very encouraging sign for your campaign, and I imagine you're very excited as you just were explaining. So I just want to let our listeners know, remind them that we have the phone lines open. That is 212-209-2877. Again, that number is 212-209-2877. Something that you had been discussing and we were kind of hitting upon was how this sort of struggle could connect to maybe the broader calls for a Green New Deal. We were talking about before the show how we've had people on talking about free mass transit and how a real eco-socialist commitment to overcoming the climate catastrophe would require eventually no cars or maybe restricting them to very specific tasks. So how can we conceive of a project, and this is really beyond the scope of the next few minutes that we have, but I think it's an important thing to hit on.
Yeah, just do your best.
How can we conceive of this kind of rake and file strategy within the UAW reimagining itself, or not reimagining itself, being a mechanism for a real broader social justice unionism movement that conceives of reconfiguring and taking the industrial capacity within these factories away from constructing cars and building things that are long-term sustainable for eco-socialist future?
Well, I mean, so there's concrete examples. So in the last round of contract negotiations, General Motors actually shut down, four auto plants, three in the United States and one in Canada, specifically in Oshawa. And the workers there actually organized together to do their own white paper study of what would it take for this plant to be converted to building sustainable green, you know, manufacturing. And there wasn't the political will in the country to do it, but the workers were showing, like, look, this can be done here. So it's not hard to imagine that in a different political context, that kind of rank and file activity actually emerging and leading to something like taking over the factories. So in Detroit, they've been talking about what if we had, like, the Tennessee Valley Authority that was created in the New Deal, right, to create all these dams in the South. What if we had something similar in Michigan that was having a whole conversation about how we get federal funding to nationalize and take over these plants that have been closed and to convert convert them to being able to benefit our communities and to be able to benefit the world, right? And I think that's a very exciting prospect that a lot of people could get brought on board to.
This is a very, very exciting conversation. I think we need to have you back on to discuss it further, but I want to make sure that we get our listeners on the air and get their chance to respond to what we're talking about today. So you are live on WBAI. This is Revolutions Per Minute. What's your name and what's your question or comment? Please keep it brief because we want to get to all our callers before we have Lee call in at the end of the show.
Are you talking to me?
Yeah, I'm talking to you. You're live on air.
Yeah, yeah. Hi, my name is Bill, and I just wanted to know, you know, since Ronald Reagan and that recent court decision that made it like, almost impossible for the union to collect money, and they still have to represent non-paying union members, non-paying workers, how do they survive, you know? I now work for the state. And believe it or not, I got to pay a percentage of my salary towards my union dues. And I'm not getting anything that I used to get. I'm paying 20% of my, which is incredible for my wife and I. It's almost $300 a month for medical. How do we turn that around, you know?
Thank you so much for that great question. Chris, do you want to try and go after that?
Yeah, unfortunately, the situation that you're in is very common across the country. Workers in all unions in both the public and the private sector are saying, oh my God, like things are so much worse than they used to be, right? We've seen this decline in our working conditions, a decline in our standards. And the only solution to that, unfortunately, is organizing. You have to work with your coworkers to rebuild your union, to have power on the job. Unfortunately, many of the unions in the past 40 years, as neoliberalism has decimated our communities, they have actually incorporated the neoliberal model. So they've concentrated decision making at the top. They've relied on highly paid, highly salaried staff to do the majority of the work. And the majority of members are disempowered, and people think that they're apathetic. But as we've seen from all the strike activity, especially among teachers, they are not apathetic. People really care about these issues, and when they're given an opportunity to take action on them, they often will. But we have to build that political will. That means we have to form caucuses. We have to build organization, take over our unions, and start leading the fight back.
Gee, Chris, do you know of any organizations that help people learn how to organize?
I do. Yeah, that would be Labor Notes. And you can find us at labornotes.org. We have multiple books on this very topic, including Secrets of a Successful Organizer and How to Jumpstart Your Union.
Wow, sounds great.
That was a really great answer, Chris. And let's jump to our next caller. You are live on Revolutions Per Minute, WBAI. What's your name and what's your comment or question? Please keep it brief because we got to get to our live report from Albany.
Yeah, my name is Rory from New Jersey. I'm wondering your thoughts on New Jersey legislation in the Senate Bill 921, that would introduce a fair scheduling bill to end sort of unpredictable work shifts. A lot of people in restaurants they might get their shifts a couple days before the week starts, so they can't plan anything on the weekend. They can't. It really holds a lot of people back. I was wondering your thoughts on this. Whether people in New York have been organizing around this. I don't know if New York already achieved this kind of thing. So I don't know, what are your thoughts on a fair scheduling bills?
I mean, that sounds like a great idea. I'm not aware of that specific legislation, so I'd have to look into it a little bit more. Maybe that's something that we can have a discussion on another episode coming up.
I think we do have it in New York. Have you heard of that? No, I think we do have it in New York. The fair scheduling, you have to have it 2 weeks in advance. The problem is enforcement, as with a lot of these things.
Always is.
Right, especially in the service industry. And that's a persistent issue with organizing in the service industry, among other issues there. But yeah, I think that from the perspective of service industry workers, those fair scheduling laws make an enormous difference. It's one of those things that seems very simple, as it's really about worker dignity more than anything else and the ability to have a life outside of your job. And I think the employer resistance to it really points to how so much of labor organizing is actually less economic than more about power and control, right? More about, well, why can't you have your schedule 2 weeks in advance? Because I just don't want to give it to you. So that's an excellent question, and I do thank you for introducing that into this conversation, because I think service industry and food industry organizing is one of the most exciting sectors that we're seeing right now.
I know UFCW Local 400, which is in Virginia, right to work states in the South, they do great organizing around this. They actually have in their contract specific wording that says that you have to have the schedule out so far in advance. And the stewards will go around if it's not posted on time, and they'll get all the workers together. They'll make their own schedule, and they'll march in on the boss and put it down on the table and say, there it is. Mm. And they'll file a grievance, and it's either you can go to arbitration with it, or you accept what we put together. So enforcement's an important part of it. It could also be a great organizing opportunity.
Absolutely.
And I want to apologize to our other two callers on the line. We're going to have to hear from you next week. I'm sure you had great thoughts, but now we're going to turn to Lee Zishi, who is live in Albany after a National Grid hearing. Lee, can you hear us? Lee, are you there? We're gonna try Lee again. Lee lost connection, so we're gonna try her again. Hopefully we'll get that report. Just for now, we're going to I think what we've been talking about today is just really how crucial it is to build working power. We've been seeing the really exciting results in the Democratic primary. For anyone who's a socialist or has progressive ideals, I think it has to be encouraging that Bernie Sanders is winning. But in order to enact any of that program, it's going to have to be worker power, rank and file, taking action. So I believe we have Lee now on Revolutions Per Minute. Lee, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
All right, great. So can you give us a little update about what was happening up in Albany today? Please keep it brief. We only got a couple minutes left.
Yeah, so I was in Albany today because National Grid, like Con Ed, wants to raise our monthly bills to pay for a bunch of frack gas infrastructure, including a frack gas pipeline in North Brooklyn and liquefied natural gas trucks on our streets. The organization I work for, Sane Energy Project, has been arguing that this is ridiculous, that we are in a time of climate crisis. We should not be investing more in fossil fuels, but this is how National Grid makes money. You know, the more they invest in gas infrastructure, pipelines, compressor stations, things like that, the more money their shareholders make. So we got to question them today. We found out that they are not really testing for greenhouse gas emissions. They're not looking at radioactivity in gas, which we know is a problem since this gas is coming from the Marcellus Shale. So I, you know, went into that room, asked them some questions. You know, New York State should have been doing this. New York City should have been doing this. But unfortunately, our government is not fighting for us in these spaces, which is, you know, why groups like DSA are fighting for public power. So I had like my blazer on that was, you know, painted. It's by a group called Rebrand Official. And it was some official, you know, public power swag. So it was kind of cool to bring that into this room full of bureaucrats and lawyers and, you know, say that what New Yorkers really want is, you know, renewable energy. And we definitely don't want our monthly bills to be going up to pay for more pipelines in our communities.
Well, thank you so much, Lee, for that really great update from Albany. And thank you for at least trying to fight back and for all the work that you do fighting back against fossil capital here in New York while our government is doing nothing. So we only have a few seconds left in the show. And I just also want to remind our listeners that next week we'll be talking to AOC endorsed Samuelise Lopez about some of these issues that Lee just shared. Chris, do you have a last quick comment you want to add?
Yeah, I would just encourage anybody who is a UAW member that's listening to go to uawd.org in order to find out more about the movement to reform the UAW. And if you have any organizing questions, you can go to labornotes.org as well.
So this has been Revolutions Per Minute. I'm Jack Devine.
I'm Amy Wilson.
And you've been tuning in at WBAI 99.5 FM. Revolutions Per Minute will be back next week at 5 p.m. Thank you for tuning in.
We'll see you on the shop floor.